What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Matt Rees, co-author of the new thriller, The Ambassador, with the late Israeli diplomat Yehuda Avner. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Here in southern Arizona, where I live, summer is officially over. School has resumed for kindergarten through 12th grade students. College classes begin shortly, and Hebrew and religious school starts this coming week. While much of the rest of America believes summer goes through Labor Day, here in the Sonoran Desert, for some reason, we think it ends with July. The seasons are changing. The High Holy Days are coming up in about a month. Rosh Hashanah begins September 13th. Today, we begin the new Hebrew calendar month of Elul, last month of the Jewish year. In Elul, it's traditional to begin to think about the state of our relationships, to prepare to do a cheshbon hanefesh, an accounting of the state of our souls, to reflect on where we are in our lives, where we've been, and where we're headed. We begin the yearly journey of getting ready for the Chagim, the Jewish fall festivals, examining the choices we continually make, and the way our choices have worked out for us in this past year. How has this year been for you? What might you have done differently than you did over the last 11 months, and how can you change over the next month as you prepare for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the Jewish New Year and the Day of Atonement, when we all make tshuva, repentance to God and to our fellow human beings? To remind us that tshuva, repentance and return, is more than a two-day-a-year process, we sound the shofar each day of the month of Elul, awakening us to the need to reform and return to the best that we can be, to apologize to those we've wronged or injured. The shofar is a kind of symbolic way to wake up our souls, to return us to the best within us. Blowing the ram's horn, the shofar, wakes anybody up, whether symbolically or otherwise. A shofar, for those of you who aren't too clear, is a horn from any appropriate kosher animal, usually a ram, but it can be anything else except a cow that has a large enough horn to blow. We hollow out the horn, sometimes curve it or ornament it with some carving, clean it, and then a proper aperture is assured at one end of the horn. You can actually make a real horn shofar of your own. Our school children do so in our Temple Emmanuel Kern Religious School. And with a bit of practice, okay, a lot of practice, you too can learn to blow shofar. At my temple, Temple Emmanuel, we blow it before every Friday night service in the month of Elul, before Shabbat begins. We blow it at Hebrew and religious school services. We blow it at classes, at meetings, pretty much any and every excuse we can come up with in this month of Elul, we blow the shofar. It's a dramatic and beautiful way to experience the urgency of the coming High Holy Days. And it's fun, too. An ancient, haunting sound that's nonetheless oddly beautiful and dramatic. Now, since the shofar is not a machined instrument, you're not always sure just what sounds will come out, but they will be loud. I brought my own shofar along this morning, well, one of the 20 or so shofarot that I own anyway, and I thought I'd get us started with a little Jewish reveille, a kind of blow-in to Too Jewish this morning. So, here goes. Well, if you weren't awake yet, now you are. To play us in this morning more elegantly, On the same theme of the shofar and this coming season, we begin with the setting of the classic Rosh Hashanah text, Taka B'Shofar, sound the great shofar of freedom, proclaiming liberty and gathering exiles from the four corners of the earth to return, perhaps even to return to temple for services on Rosh Hashanah.
Taka, Taka B'Shofar Gadol Leherutenu. Mesales, mesales, lekabez galuyotenu, bekabtenu yahad, mehera, mehera, me'al bakan kotaretz, me'atzenu.
Teka, teka b'shofar gadol lecherutenu, Kabet galu yotengo fe kabetzeinu yachad mehera mehera
me'ar bakan fotaret me'atzeinu teka teka b'shofar gadol lecherutengo.
That was Teka B'Shofar for the coming High Holy Days. The season of the shofar is recorded by my dad, Rabbi and cantor Baruch Kohan. What if Israel had existed in 1938 and there had been a refuge for Jews during the Holocaust? When we return a few moments here on Two Jewish, our guest, Matt Rees, will explore what it was like to write a counterfactual thriller based on very real and tragic events, to reimagine history while working with the renowned Israeli diplomat Yehuda Avner on that book. Find out about the ambassador when we come back in a few moments right here on Two Jewish.
Everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's famous Taste of Judaism program, now in its 16th year, offers an exploration of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community, taught by our rabbis. Call 327-4501 for more information and to register today. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity to learn about Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. The classes are free and open to all, and we feed you too. We have daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and this year in Suarita as well. In partnership with the Tucson Hebrew Academy, the whole family can learn at the Taste of Judaism family class. And we're thrilled to offer American Sign Language Interpretation, ASL, for one of the sessions. Remember, there are no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 327-4501 or email mila@templeemmanueltucson.org. That's Taste of Judaism, 520-327-4501, a fun way to learn about Judaism. Don't miss it.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through 8th grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Matt Rees is an award-winning novelist, author of a variety of mysteries about the Palestinian sleuth Omar Youssef and a series of best-selling crime novels. He's been published in 25 languages. His new book, The Ambassador, was written with Israeli former ambassador, the late Yehuda Avner, who was also the English speechwriter for a number of Israeli prime ministers, beginning with Levi Eshkol, Golda Meir, Yitzhak Rabin, Menachem Begin, and serves as an advisor to many of them as well. Good morning and welcome, Matt.
Good to be with you, Sam.
So, fascinating premise to the book. It takes us back to Berlin before the war, and there's a State of Israel. Tell us how the idea for the book came about and how you ran with it.
Well, the first idea came to my co-author, Yehuda, when he was at Mount Herzl in Jerusalem on Holocaust Memorial Day. He was listening to Shimon Peres some years ago, and Shimon Peres said, as it were, to the dead of the Holocaust, we were 10 years too late.
Right.
And Yehuda thought, well, what if we hadn't been? 1948, yes, it was 10 years too late, but what if Israel had been founded in 1938? And then he came up with the idea of, well, Israel very nearly was founded 10 years earlier. In 1938, the British had a royal commission called the Peel Commission, which said there should be a division, a partition of the land. It was almost went through because the British cabinet was in favor. Ben-Gurion accepted it, but there was a revolt of the Palestinian Arabs. And so the British abandoned the plan because they thought it was too much trouble. So what we did once we sat down to write the book was to say, okay, if there had been a state, how would that have changed the Holocaust, the progress of the Holocaust? If there had been an Israeli ambassador, what could he have done to help the Jews? And so the main character is Dan Levy, the Israeli ambassador to Berlin, the Israeli ambassador to Adolf Hitler.
It's a fascinating premise. I'm reminded of a short story, kind of the other direction, also kind of fictional history, which talked about the Mossad sending somebody back in a time machine to kill Hitler before he became Hitler in Austria in 1920 or so. And then the time machine brings him back to the Middle East, only there's a Palestinian flag flying over what had been Israel. So this is kind of the reverse of that.
Well, we didn't want to do anything which said, okay, someone could have gone, done something differently, and then bang, no Holocaust, everyone's happy.
Right.
We wanted to show that decisive actions in history can be important, but we didn't want to say, you know, the Holocaust was just because of one guy who was a psychopath. We wanted to say, even with decisive action, you still face these enormous historical flows, which Hitler managed to channel in some way, but it was bigger than him. So we don't say, okay, you know, there's no Holocaust in the book. There are definitely still large amounts of Jews being killed. But one of the things that we wanted to get at was a fact that I turned up during the course of our research, that when, as they do in the book, the Nazis sat down at the Wannsee conference to really plot the final solution, 80% of the people who died in the Holocaust were still alive. And 16 months later, 80% of them were dead. Mm-hmm. So one decisive action at that time wouldn't have meant that no one died, but it would have meant that the Holocaust had very different dimensions. And that's really what we're getting at.
We will talk much more with Matt Reese when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's 4 ingredients in electronic cigarettes. propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast. You know, we have more than 14 months to go until the election for President of the United States, but it's better to be early than late. So we continue our special election year or so feature, the 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. In-depth coverage, unusual features, and the finest opinion on the air as we choose the new leader for our nation. According to the polls, the ideal presidential candidate for the United States these days is probably Jewish. More Americans say they would vote for a Jewish candidate than an evangelical Christian, an atheist, or a Muslim. In fact, 91% of Americans say they would vote for a presidential candidate who is Jewish, according to Gallup. The recent Gallup poll of voting preferences showed that 73% of Americans would support an evangelical Christian, 60% would back a Muslim, and 58% would support an atheist. But 91% would vote for a Jew. The latest results on voting for a Jewish candidate match those from 2012. Gallup has been around for a long time, though, and attitudes have definitely changed. When the question about religion was first asked in 1937, less than half of all Americans said they would vote for a Jewish candidate. Democrats at 92% and Republicans at 95% expressed great willingness to vote for a Jewish candidate. Apparently, independents were a little lower. But they differed in their willingness to vote for candidates of various other faiths. Among Republicans, 84% said they'd vote for an evangelical, 66% of Democrats. More Democrats are willing to vote for a Muslim, 73%, than Republicans, just 45%. And some 64% of Democrats would vote for an atheist, but just 45% of Republicans. Well, there's only one Jewish candidate running currently, Democrat Bernie Sanders, but 91% of Americans say religion would not stop them from voting for him. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, our community shlicha, Oshrat Bariel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So you were in Israel this summer, which is a great time to be in Israel. I was in Israel in the middle of winter this year, which was also not so bad. You had a great trip, and although you're from Beit She'an, not from Jerusalem, you can't go to Israel without going to Jerusalem. Let's talk about Jerusalem today.
Yeah, actually, it was. I must say that as a shlicha, when I'm going back to Israel, it's like to be a tourist in your own country.
It's strange, isn't it?
It's amazing. It's just give you, you know that you're in Israel for a couple of weeks.
Yeah,
a couple of weeks, and you need to
see
take
everybody
the best
and
of it.
See everything, right?
See family, see sights, and as a shlicha, of course, I need to bring some, you know, news and stuff. So very busy, but very happy. So what I've learned since I visited Jerusalem, I think, twice, and one of the times that I visited there, I also, after that, I met with the head of the fire services in Jerusalem because he will be here in Tucson in 2 months from now.
I know he's going to be speaking at Temple Emmanuel, by the way.
Yeah. So anyway, so he taught me a little bit about Jerusalem in terms of fire services, like 800 people lives in Jerusalem. Third of them are Palestinian.
800,000 people in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
I thought it was maybe great.
Yeah, that's the numbers he gave me.
Keeps going up, doesn't it?
Yeah, third of them are Palestinian. Third of them are Haredian, and third of them is.
So a third of them are ultra Orthodox. A third of them are Palestinian, and then the other third
and the
are
Palestinian holds.
Israelis.
It's not a Palestinian. It's Israeli Arabs who holds an Israeli ID, a blue Tehudat Zehut. And a Jordanian passport.
So they have Jordanian passports. They're Israeli Arabs with Jordanian passports who live in Jerusalem.
Yeah. And it was fascinating for me because as an Israeli, I would never ask for this information, but as a shlicha. So anyway, so we took the long way to the Kotel. It was only Eli, me, and Shira.
Oh, nice.
And it was the week of Tisha B'Av, so it was very unique.
The commemoration of the 9th of Av, the destruction of the first and second temples, a very powerful time to
powerful
be in,
time, yeah.
On the way to and, the wall, yeah.
And it was very nice to explain Shira, what these stones are all about, and then
that fallen arch was the walkway up onto the Har HaBayit, and
yes.
It came down, we know exactly when, right?
Yeah. And to see her holding a siddur, of course, ups and down ups, and praying for Safta, for grandma, was very powerful for us.
Sure.
Jerusalem was great, and then Machane Yehuda and an amazing restaurant called Hamotzi.
Oh.
Hamotzi, that's the name of
the name
restaurant.
Is Hamotzi.
Hamotzi,
which is the
it's a beautiful Moroccan food.
Ah.
Highly recommended for next time for
I'm
you.
I'm going. I'll go there in May when I'm back. I don't go there, I'll be there.
So it was beautiful.
February also. So.
February.
There's a convention. There's always a convention in Israel. Great experience. And Jerusalem, always a fantastic place. Thanks, Oshrat. We'll talk next
Toda
week.
Rabbi.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Iran has been very much in the news because of the possibility of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons and the treaty and all the rest of it. But it's a very big, complicated country, talking about some of the complexities of it ethnically, geographically, religiously. Let's talk about the regime a little bit. When the Shah was overthrown, we had a great and painful experience of American captives and the Ayatollah Khomeini. Now it's a different Ayatollah, but his name is almost the same. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with the regime in Iran and what resistance has arisen to it.
Right. So I remember that hostage situation very well because I was actually working in the State Department Operations Center when their release was arranged. And there was a great deal of euphoria because these were our colleagues, obviously. And I think at the time, nobody expected that such an extremely repressive regime would last as long as it has. Nobody expected it would have such staying power.
It's more than 35 years. I mean, it's incredible, really.
Right. And I think, one of the things that people who have visited Iran or who know many Iranis, even outside of Iran, are struck with is how many Iranis are convinced that their nation is truly special, that it is the birthplace of civilization, that it's the oldest civilization in the world, that everything was really invented there, whether it's the airplane or the camera or the automobile or whatever. This is not only crazies or extremists. This is sort of run-of-the-mill Iranis believe that their nation really is special in the way that many Americans once believed that our nation was truly special and one of a kind.
Well, some still do, I think, in America.
But there's a great deal of pride that crosses ethnic and religious groups. It's not only Muslims who feel this way. It's not only supporters of the regime. So many Iranis, even if they're not Muslim, or even if they're not remotely fundamentalist, and even if they're strongly opposed to the current regime, also have kind of a chip on their shoulder about how much their country is misunderstood and how it's misperceived in the outside world. And it's a shame that more people don't come to visit and discover the true Iran. I did find the Iranis to be incredibly hospitable when I was there. And more than that, historically, if you look at the Islamic world, there were kind of three parties, three civilizations almost, fighting for leadership and dominance in the Islamic world. The Arabs, obviously, who introduced Islam to the world, built the first Islamic empire, once ruled a landmass ranging from Western China to the Straits of Gibraltar. I mean, a huge empire. And then the Persians always made a bid for at least cultural and linguistic and artistic dominance, even if they never tried for territorial dominance. Although they did once have a pretty big empire in Central Asia, stretching from, let's say, the eastern frontiers of Turkey to almost the western frontiers of China. Never as big as the Arab Empire, but still much larger than the current state of Iran. And then the third party was the Turks, or the Turkic peoples, and most notably the Ottomans, who also had a huge empire that lasted for, you know, roughly 600 years. Anyway, these three sort of poles of power were always struggling for dominance. And there's a sense in which the Persians today, by supporting Shiite extremists and certain terrorist groups and whatever, are playing out their historic role of attempting to be one of the leaders of the Islamic world. And I guess we've run out of time. Sorry.
We will talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set for May 29th to June 9th of 2016. If you're interested in coming with me on this fantastic journey to the Holy Land, seeing all of Israel from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, please email twojewishradio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Three Jewish brothers get together to talk about the great gifts they sent their mother for her 90th birthday. One, Milton, is a successful doctor. The second, Marvin, is a powerful lawyer. And the third, Melvin, is a prosperous businessman. It's too bad their aged mama lives so far away in another city across the country, but they really have each gone all out. The first brother, Milton, says, "I had a big new mansion built for mama." The second, Marvin, says, "I had my Mercedes dealer deliver her a fancy Mercedes limousine with a special Mercedes-trained German chauffeur." The third son, Melvin, says, "Listen to this. You know how Mama loves reading Torah? She can't read anymore, though, because she can't see. So I met this rabbi who told me about a parrot that can recite the whole Torah with commentary. It took 20 rabbis 12 years to teach the parrot. I did have to pledge to contribute $1 million to the temple, but let me tell you, it was worth it. All Mama has to do is name a Torah portion, and the parrot will chant it and give the commentary." Well, the other brothers were very impressed. Soon after her 90th birthday, Mama sent her sons thank you notes. She wrote, "It's a shame none of you could make it here for my birthday because you're all such big shots now and I was all alone. But all right, thank you for your gifts." First, Milton. The house you had built for me is so huge. I live in only one room and maybe the kitchen a little, but I have to clean the whole house. Thanks anyway. Next, Marvin. Look, I'm too old to go anywhere. Why do I need the big fancy car? I stay home. I never use the Mercedes except to go to the doctor. Plus, the driver you hired is a Nazi. He's eating me out of house and home. But the thought was good. Thanks. Ah, but my dearest Melvin, you were the only son to have the good sense to give a little thought to your gift. The chicken was delicious. You see, she thought the parrot was a chicken, the one trained to do the Torah, and she cooked it and ate. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. This week's portion from Deuteronomy is called Shoftim, Judges. It establishes a process for the administration of justice and includes one of the most powerful statements in all religious, philosophical, or ethical tradition. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Justice, justice you shall pursue. In the Torah, which has no extra words, no kefel lashon, a repetition of a word means that it has additional importance and power. Here the word for justice, tzedek, is repeated, emphasizing that justice is extraordinarily significant. We must be not only fair in life, but truly just. Even more than that, the Torah teaches us, we must not only be just, but tirdof, pursue justice, chase after it, make it a goal for our own lives and our civilization. It's not enough to act well in a place where justice is not the norm. We must strive to change an unjust situation into a just one. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Each one of us must pursue true justice. It's easy to understand that for Jews, justice underlies everything good in society. Without justice, there is no peace. Without justice, there is no morality. Without justice, we simply can't trust our government or its leaders to act well. Even love is only truly possible where there is respect and a sense of fairness, which are in essence aspects of a sense of justice. Be just, God commands. Never accept injustice as a permanent condition of life. Chase justice in your own life. Work for justice in your society, and then good will come. It's a great and holy message in a society like ours in which the pursuit of happiness sometimes seems to be the ultimate goal. But that's just happiness. The better pursuit, indeed the most meaningful real pursuit, is justice. May our actions and our words help make our society more just this week and in the coming new year. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, crime and thriller writer Matt Reese, will explore what it was like reimagining the world before the Holocaust with an existing state of Israel and what it was like to write with Yehuda Avner. Find out when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Israel, the Rabbanut, the chief Orthodox rabbinate, is seeing its authority in the area of conversions challenged significantly for the first time in the history of the modern state. And that's a good thing. Last week, six minors were converted to Judaism in a private ceremony conducted by religious Zionist rabbis, marking the first act of mutiny against the chief rabbinate's restrictive control over conversion. The ceremony came in the wake of the government's decision to bury an initiative for conversion reform. One of the goals of the conversion law and of the attempted conversion reform was to facilitate the conversion of minors, those who are under the age of 13, a relatively quick and easy procedure from the perspective of traditional Jewish law, halacha. However, there is wall-to-wall opposition among rabbis from the chief rabbinate and in the ultra-Orthodox community, the Haredim, to conversions of minors, even though these rely on the halachic rulings of major rabbis. The government decided at the beginning of July to cancel the conversion reform it had adopted just 8 months earlier. That reform was meant to enable municipal rabbis to convert non-Jewish Israelis, particularly minors, to Judaism. In the wake of the cancellation, these Zionist rabbis began acting independently of the chief rabbinate and its conversion courts. They have now established a private religious court separate from the chief rabbinate to convert both adults and children with parental approval. Last week's ceremony was performed by Rabbi Nachum Rabinowitz, a leading Zionist rabbi, along with two other well-known rabbis, Rabbi Reem HaKohen, head of the Otniel Yeshiva, and Rabbi Ariel Holland from the settlement of Tekoa. The rabbis and organizational heads involved in the conversion stressed that the new religious court will completely fulfill all halachic Jewish legal requirements for conversion while accompanying the converts after conversion. This new process is supposed to help the thousands of people whose legal status in Israel is in limbo because they cannot convert to Judaism under the chief rabbinate's insane regulations. They called on Sephardi chief Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef to cooperate with them. Besides Rabinowitz, a host of prominent rabbis are taking part in the private religious court, including Rabbi Yaakov Medan of Har Etzion Yeshiva, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, chief rabbi of Efrat, and Rabbi David Stav, chief rabbi of Shoham and chairman of the Tzohar Rabbinical Association. That Tzohar group is also tied the initiative that was accepted by the Jewish Agency to establish a private, mobile religious court, a Beit Din that will assist with conversion in communities abroad. The Jewish Agency is also involved in this new religious court, along with a variety of NGOs. Opponents of the chief rabbinate's power and obstinacy applauded the move. Minister of Religious Services Naftali Bennett, himself a religious Zionist, said that all of Israel's religious services, including conversion, should be performed by the official state body, the Rabbanut. Unfortunately, the rabbinate is not functioning as it should, and this is why other conversion bodies were formed, Bennett said. This is a wake-up call for the rabbinate to pull itself together and undergo reform that would make other conversion courts unnecessary. We believe that any move to establish community institutions that will offer the public a variety of religious services using different approaches will strengthen Israel's Jewish and democratic identity, said Rabbi Gilad Kariv, director of the Israeli branch of the Reform Movement and a past guest of Two Jewish. It's clear the new rabbinical court's halachic Jewish legal policy differs from ours, but we believe a multiplicity of approaches in Israeli Judaism is a blessing and source of strength. Unlike the new rabbinical court, which will focus on converting minors, the Reform Movement's conversion court will continue to open its doors to Israeli citizens of all ages. It is certainly highly desirable to make it possible for the many backlog Israelis who wish to convert to Judaism or have their children do so without further obstruction from the chief rabbinate. There are literally tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of Israelis who wish to clarify their legal Jewish status formally and have been prevented from doing so by the Rabbanut. These cracks in the foundation of the troubled organization are actually positive news, a breath of fresh air for Judaism in Israel. Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes ah. And there is now a new synagogue near the iconic beach in Ipanema, Brazil, and it is something. 1,200 people attended last week's inauguration of a new four-story, 440-seat Orthodox synagogue in Rio de Janeiro, named for Edmund Safra, the late Brazilian Jewish billionaire and philanthropist whose foundation funded most of the project. The 20,000-square-foot building replaces a much smaller synagogue. The facade is made of Jerusalem stone shipped directly from Israel. The congregation of 1,000 families is mostly made up of Sephardic families originally from Syria and Lebanon. The new complex includes mikvahs, a social hall, classrooms, a Beit Midrash for study, and a recreation area. Last year, Ipanema, an upscale neighborhood home to many affluent Jews, and the adjacent coastal neighborhood of Copacabana, received a new Eruv, the demarcation of area that permits observant Jews to carry objects on Shabbat. Rio de Janeiro, Brazil's second largest city, is home to about 35,000 Jews. Oh, and by the way, the American sax player on Girl from Ipanema was Stan Getz, a Jewish boy not from Brazil, but from the Bronx, mostly. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Matt Reese, is the award-winning novelist, author of a series of mysteries about the Palestinian sleuth Omar Youssef. He's written a number of best-selling crime novels published in 25 languages. His very first one won the UK Crime Writers Association New Blood Dagger, which I want to know what that award looks like, actually. As a foreign correspondent, he reported from all around the Middle East, the Financial Times for Time Magazine and The Scotsman in a previous life. His new book is called The Ambassador, written with the late Yehuda Avner, the prominent Israeli diplomat. Matt, what directed you to move from reporting things that were happening to writing about things in a creative way? What was the impetus to switch to novels?
On the one hand, it's what I always wanted to do. I became a journalist because I loved writing, and I thought, well, journalists write, so let's try that. but really, what I always wanted to do was to write creatively, and I always did. But in some ways, I didn't find the material until I was in Israel and covering Israel and the Palestinians. When I was covering the Intifada from 2000 to 2005, I felt restricted by journalism's objectivity. I felt that I wasn't able to write about how people really felt or really thought, or the dirty things that were hard to document objectively, but which I know were going on. And so all those things made me turn to my first novel, which was called The Collaborator of Bethlehem, which won the dagger that you mentioned, which actually is a dagger. The prize is they give you a dagger, which they gave it to me in London, and I had to get on El Al the next day. It took me a little explaining, you know, why do you have a dagger?
Is this a dagger that I see before me? Come, let me clutch
thee. Exactly, yes, and it has my name on it, too, which was even stranger to explain.
You've written really movingly. I would say, in a way, it seems sort of objective from a Palestinian perspective about the real challenge of living in Israel, living under the occupation in the West Bank, dealing with what people are dealing with in Gaza. Your novels feel like they're taken straight out of the pages, or the pages that we don't get to read, of the newspapers and magazines today. How have they been received in the Palestinian population?
They've been very well received by Palestinians both inside the West Bank and Gaza, and by Palestinians who I've met in Europe when I've been on book tours. Essentially, Palestinians feel like they don't really have a voice. You know, the foreign journalists tend to cover them as stereotypes. They're either a stereotypical victim or a stereotypical terrorist. And then their own media just says, well, everything's the fault of Israel, which isn't always true, of course. So when I've talked to them about my books, or when they've talked to me about their books, they really appreciate that I've given them that kind of voice politically, if you like. But also one of the things that I focused on doing was trying to give them just a very natural feel. So when my Palestinian characters are speaking, you know, I speak Hebrew and Arabic, so I tried to give them the not just the cadences of real Arabic, even though I was writing in English, but also some of the patterns of speech. For example, you know, when Raymond Chandler said, when you want to change, when you run out of ideas, just have a man come through a door with a gun. But if he's a Palestinian and he's coming through the door and everyone in the room is Palestinian, he can't just come in and say, hands up, everyone, get out. He has to offer blessings and accept their blessings and then drink coffee with them and so on. It changes the whole social aspect of the book, each of which is taking place in a fairly small Palestinian town, really, in a fairly small society. And so Palestinians have said to me that they thought a Palestinian had written it, just as I've had Israelis, when I've written some other things, say, you know, well, we know you're Jewish because you really get it. You know, and it's very interesting that I can be in both those dimensions. And it's really because I just am, despite the fact that I'm doing a lot of talking now, I'm actually a very good listener, and I'm able to listen on an emotional level. I can pick up emotional things, which I think is fairly unusual for a journalist, because journalists like to tell people what's going on rather than really to listen. And I also feel it's fairly unusual for a man, because I think this is something that women are very good at doing, but most men I know are not so good at listening on an emotional level.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening, Matt. No, those are high compliments indeed for Palestinians to tell you they thought a Palestinian wrote it, and for Jews, for Israelis to say, oh, it has to be, you know, only a Jew would be able to write this. Tell us a little bit about your partnership with Yehuda Avner, how that evolved, what it was like to write with him, and of course, the sadness of his passing.
Strangely, it was the most fun either of us have had doing anything, I think. You know, on the day that he and I sat down to start working on the book, an hour before, he had been told by his doctor that he had 3 months to live. He had cancer. He was in his 80s, and we both thought, well, how is this going to turn out? But as it happened, it was fabulous. I think the writing the book gave him a lot of life, gave him a lot of creative energy, even as his body was failing. His mind was really there. And for me, it was a real perspective on the pressures that I normally feel when I write a book. I'm normally thinking, okay, is the book going to work? Is it going to sell? Am I going to make enough money to feed my family? You know what? I didn't care. I thought, okay, I've got 3 months. I'm just going to enjoy this. It's really an engaging subject. And it was wonderful. You would think, wouldn't you, you know, that writing a book about the Holocaust with a man who has a terminal illness would be a downer. But it was the most fun we both of us had. Maybe ever, I think.
You know, extraordinary opportunity. A man who was behind the scenes of power for so long, knew so many of the key players. Was that a unique experience?
As a journalist, I've had relationships with lots of Israeli politicians and diplomats, but it was much more intimate with Yehuda, and it's not only because he was dying, but also because he is a man with a very different character. He is really a very warm and open man. So it was a different kind of relationship. But for me, it was fabulous to be in a situation where we could write with complete freedom, really. It was almost as though there were no consequences for him, because he was going to die, and there were no consequences for me because, it's not a book that I wrote on my own. It's a co-written book. And yet it was fabulous. In the 2 weeks after we finished it and before he died, we actually plotted out another book, which I'm writing with Toby Press now, and which will be published next year, which is even closer to his experiences, because he worked very, very closely with Menachem Begin and was very much involved in the Israeli raid on the Iraqi nuclear reactor in the 1980s.
Yeah, the Osira.
So it's another historical what if. What if that raid had failed? And that's the book we plotted out when he could no longer even stand, actually. He was so sick, but his mind was really alive to the end.
The ambassador, how did you know where you were going in advance? Did you plot out the whole book first? Did you write it, and did it evolve terms of how this different history was going to transpire?
Yehuda and I sat down for 2 weeks and figured out more or less every scene, but in a fairly loose way. We said, okay, this is going to happen in this scene, but we didn't say this is exactly what they'll say. We left that for when we would write each of those scenes. And one of his contributions was to rein me in when he, as he said, this scene is too James Bond. So we had to rein it in because it's a thriller, and sometimes, you know, you can get carried away when you're a writer. So it was nice to have him there to say, well, you know, it's fiction, but let's not have him do that. But there were moments in there where we had ideas, which I won't tell you now because obviously we want people to read the book and have them, but moments where we could kind of see each other tingling. We'd say, oh, that is a good idea. And it was so great. There are a few moments in that book which I almost wish I hadn't written it so that I could read it and be zinged by them when they happen. They're so good.
Sure sounds like a movie in there somewhere.
I would like that. Yes, the publisher is working on that at the moment. I certainly think it would that would be a good movie. Well, you know, in the documentary that was made of Yehuda's book, The Prime Minister's, Michael Douglas did one of the voiceovers. So who knows? He could be in it.
It's worth a shot. Certainly worth trying. When you write about the Middle East, and you know it intimately, and lived there, speak Hebrew and Arabic, know so many of the key players, do you find yourself torn at times?
I find myself feeling sometimes a little numb rather than torn, because I do feel that in the last couple of years there has been just a breakdown of any kind of momentum. And I know that, you know, there are some political factions that still have some momentum, if you like. But what I mean is the momentum towards an end to the violence, an end to the hatred. I do feel that there had been some progress, and it broke down. And so that's one of the things that it can be, I wouldn't say depressing to write about it, because I'm always looking for humanity, and humanity is never depressing to write about, but it can make me feel from time to time as though I need a break from this subject, which is one of the reasons why it was so nice to write about Berlin and in the 1930s and early 40s, even though there were terrible things happening there. It's just a change of pace, and it gives me a creative energy that sometimes I feel is being sucked out of me by the Middle East rather than being given to me.
There is something about the Middle East where whatever the worst thing you can think of that might happen, something worse probably just did.
Exactly. You know, we've only got to look across the border into Syria to see pretty much the worst things that are happening in the world at the moment. And yes, and, you know, I think a lot of Israelis somewhat ignore the fact that those things are getting closer.
Very close. Sometimes too close. The Ambassador is available just about now. People can find it on Amazon. Where can they go to find out more about you and all of your work?
I have a website, mattreese.net, M-A-T-T-R-E-E-S, for sugar, .net, which has not just stuff about my other books, but also some things featuring Yehuda and myself talking. You can listen to a couple of podcasts there where he and I discussed the book days before his death. It's a wonderful experience to listen to him. It's a little chilling to me because he's gone. But I think everyone, if they want to go and listen to those podcasts on mattreese.net, they would learn something about Israel and Israelis.
I can vouch for them. The podcasts are really beautiful and touching. Matt, thanks for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
It's a great pleasure, Sam. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9. Our guest will be Rabbi Niles Goldstein, author of Gonzo Judaism and his new book, Eight Questions of Faith, Biblical Challenges That Guide and Ground Our Lives. Our playout this morning is for the coming High Holy Day season. Rosh Hashanah is now just 4 weeks away, beginning September 13th. This piece is from cantor Ben Sion Miller, singing Chazan David Reutemann's Hayom Te'amtzenu from the Liturgy of the Mornings of both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Today, give us strength. Bless us. Remember us for life. This composition is kind of Jewish prayer as light opera. Anyway, my friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good beginning to the month of Elul, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Ayoy, 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 ayoy.